The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is the June 2024 edition of Education Today. The first article comes from the New York Times, and it's titled, Harvard Says It Will No Longer Take Positions on Matters Outside of the University. The policy could ease pressure on the school to issue statements on current events. Officials were criticized for their handling of the October 7 Hamas attacks. By Vimal Patel and Anamina Hartikalis, posted May 28, 2024. Harvard said on Tuesday that it would now avoid taking positions on matters that are not relevant to the core function of the university, accepting the recommendations of a faculty committee that urged the university to dramatically reduce its messages on issues of the day. If put into practice, Harvard would no longer issue official statements of empathy, which it did for Ukraine, after the Russian invasion, and for the victims of the October 7 Hamas attacks in Israel, for example. In issuing official statements of empathy, the university runs the risk of appearing to care more about some places and events than others, the report said. And because few, if any, world events can be entirely isolated from conflicting viewpoints, issuing official empathy statements runs the risk of alienating some members of the community by expressing implicit solidarity with others.
The university's Institutional Voice Working Group, made up of 8 faculty members, issued the report with a set of principles and a recommended path forward, which the administration and governing board accepted. Harvard isn't a government, Noah Feldman, a Harvard law professor and a co-chair of the committee that developed the recommendations, said in an interview with the Harvard Gazette, released Tuesday as part of the university's announcement, it shouldn't have a foreign policy or a domestic policy. The report, however, did not fully embrace institutional neutrality, a principle promoted by the University of Chicago, in which universities commit to staying out of political and social matters. Some universities, including Stanford University and Northwestern, announced shortly after the Hamas attack that they would adopt the policy. Mr. Feldman said, though the recommendations had some overlap with institutional neutrality, there were also differences. A key difference, Mr. Feldman said to the Gazette, is that, as an institution with values, we have a responsibility to promote our core function as an educational institution and defend ourselves against forces that seek to undermine our academic values. In that sense, we aren't neutral, and we can't be. In an interview, Mr. Feldman provided examples about when Harvard should weigh in on political matters. He mentioned a proposal by former President Donald J. Trump to collect billions and billions of dollars by taxing large private university endowments. Advocating against such a plan, he said, would fall squarely within the function of the university. Mr. Feldman also noted that Harvard advocated for affirmative action in the courts, and that admissions policy would count as a core function of the university. Tom Ginsberg, faculty director of the Forum for Free Inquiry and Expression at the University of Chicago, said neither of those examples run afoul of Chicago's stance on neutrality. Nevertheless, he said, he supported Harvard's new position. One of the first sentences in the Harvard report states that the university is not institutionally neutral, but then the rest of the report describes how it is committing to institutional neutrality, Mr. Ginsberg said. Their policies look like they're converging in the direction that many other schools have moved in, Mr. Ginsberg said, but they don't want to admit that. One reason for that, Mr. Ginsberg said, is that some quarters of the academy see neutrality as a misleading term, with many believing silence itself is taking a stance. Others view it as an impossibility. There is no such thing as institutional neutrality, Peter Wood, president of the National Association of Scholars, said on Tuesday. Those who claim they are going to abide by it find a myriad fallback positions in which they say, but not in this case. When it comes to matters of political salience, universities will do what they've always done. Institutional neutrality is a false flag. For years, universities had, mostly without controversy, issued messages on any number of world and local events, from the Russian invasion of Ukraine to racism at home. But perhaps unlike any other issue, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict split university communities and clarified the downsides of such statements on highly contested topics.
And we'll have to cut that article short for time. The next article comes from Education Week, and it's titled, Teachers' Unions Are Gaining Ground in a State That Once Forbade Them, by Alina Banerjee, posted June 10, 2024. Teachers' unions notched a major victory on June 10th, winning the exclusive right to collective bargaining on the behalf of 27,500 teachers and staff in Fairfax County, the country's 12th largest school district. It is a major turnaround in Virginia, historically one of a handful of southern states hostile to labor unions. And it's a sign of hope for teachers' unions at large, which have seen membership declines in recent years due to recessions, the pandemic, and unfavorable legislation and litigation, including a blow from the U.S. Supreme Court. The Fairfax Education Unions ran unopposed and won the election with an overwhelming majority after a six-month-long campaign. In bargaining, it is expected to bring wage increases and changes to heavy teacher workloads to the table.
The joint leaders of the FEU, Leslie Houston and David Walrod, began planning their campaign almost as soon as former Governor Ralph Northam, a Democrat, signed a bill in 2020 to reverse a ban on collective bargaining by public sector entities in Virginia that had spanned nearly five decades. We wanted to get collective bargaining and get our folks those rights because we know what's good for workers is ultimately good for students, said David Walrod, the president of the Fairfax County Federation of Teachers, one of the two local teachers' unions that make up the FEU. Walrod is also a special education teacher at Lake Braddock Secondary in Burke, VA. Houston, the president of the Fairfax Education Association that makes up the other half of FEU, and a learning disabilities teacher at Braddock Elementary in Annandale, VA, called the election the most successful public sector bargaining campaign won in the last 25 years. Fairfax joins a growing number of Virginia school districts, which now include Richmond and Prince William County, in achieving collective bargaining rights after a long gap of 47 years. The state Supreme Court had made it illegal for public sector entities to bargain in 1977. Some teachers' unions have lost members in the tens of thousands over the last decade, the drop triggered in part by a U.S. Supreme Court ruling in 2017 that stopped unions from requiring non-members to pay agency fees. The ruling made it easier for teachers to drop their union memberships and spurred a flurry of legislation and additional litigation to weaken teachers' unions' influence in schools. Now, affiliates in Virginia are trying to reverse course and establish collective bargaining agreements with their school boards. The bargaining agreements in Richmond and Prince William County have resulted in higher wages for teachers, classroom assistants, and other staff, and more flexible leave policies. Local organizing efforts can potentially re-energize the membership of the national unions, said Melissa Arnold-Lyon, an assistant professor of public policy at the University at Albany, SUNY. Lyon has studied the rise and fall of teachers' unions over the decades, and is watching Virginia's string of elections closely. In places where bargaining has been illegal, there is a culture built around the idea that unions protect bad teachers and should be avoided, said Lyon.
The core work for national and local unions is to change that mindset to get teachers and the general public on board. The next section is titled, An Important But Uneasy Union Alliance. Both Walrod and Houston were appointed presidents of their respective unions after the 2020 bill passed. They both felt that teaming up would make the process of collecting enough votes to become the exclusive collective bargaining unit for the county go faster. FEA's membership is about 4,000 and FCFT's 3,000, Houston said. Even so, the alliance was difficult to forge. There is some history of mistrust between our organizations. We had to start by building trust, said Walrod. The hardest part was to talk to each other's members and convince them that we weren't trying to poach them. FEU campaigned at more than 244 work sites, including schools and bus stops, often spending 7 days a week in school buildings to collect signed cards in favor of collective bargaining. The union also had to educate teachers and staff about their right to collective bargaining in a state that had prohibited it for so long. Virginia did not have a union culture for over 47 years. We had to convince them, the workers, that no one would force them to pay union dues, even if we represented them in collective bargaining, Walrod said. And we'll have to cut that article short for time. The next article comes from NBC News, and it's titled, A Philadelphia Art School Gave 7 Days Notice It Was Closing. Now, its students and faculty want answers. The nearly 150-year-old University of the Arts announced it would be shutting its doors in a statement May 31st, after news of its closure had already begun to leak. Posted June 14, 2024, by Maya Eaglin and Lily Umana. Students and staff members from the University of the Arts in Philadelphia are scrambling to figure out their next steps after the school's abrupt closure last week and are calling on the university to answer questions about why it shut down so quickly. The university announced it would be shutting its doors in a statement on May 31st, after news had already begun to leak about an hour and a half earlier, saying in part that it, quote, has been in a fragile financial state, with many years of declining enrollments, declining revenues, and increasing expenses. The nearly 150-year-old university, a longtime home for artists of all kinds, shut down a week later on June 7th, leaving its more than 1,000 students and hundreds of faculty and staff confused and anxious.
Among them is Owen Spalos, who walked across the stage at the university's graduation in May, but still needs to complete a 3-credit summer internship to receive his degree in creative writing. The unexpected shutdown has put his once imminent degree completion at least temporarily out of reach. A lot of these universities don't have a creative writing major, and even if they do, there's no guarantee that they would accept all of my credits or that they would accept scholarships, Spalos said. The only reason I can afford to go to the University of the Arts is because of the donors and the scholarships that I've gotten. I couldn't financially afford this on my own. News of the University of the Arts closure has led to protests on campus by students and staffers alike who question why the university didn't alert its community sooner or better prepare for its financial failure. The university did not respond to requests for comment. Krista Apple, who has worked at the university for more than 10 years and was serving as the director of the Bachelor of Fine Arts and Acting program, said she didn't initially believe the school was closing after learning about it first in a Philadelphia Inquirer article. I thought it was a joke. Or I thought the Inquirer had gotten something wrong. I thought maybe somebody was pranking me, Apple said. Students and staff said the Inquirer article made the rounds on social media, group texts, and emails before the university released a statement. Some community members said they first heard about the closure on TikTok. It continues to be disorienting and heartbreaking. This is a massive loss of community for all of us who taught and worked together for many years. It's also a massive loss for the city of Philadelphia, Apple said. Our students really were one of a kind, both in terms of the cohort of humans that they were, but also individually. The university said in the statement, announcing its closure, that it had worked hard this year alongside many of you to take steps that would secure the university's sustainability. The progress we made together has been impressive. Unfortunately, however, we could not overcome the ultimate challenge we faced. With a cash position that has steadily weakened, we could not cover significant, unanticipated expenses. The situation came to light very suddenly. Despite swift action, we were unable to bridge the necessary gaps. The university's accreditation was withdrawn June 1st, 3 days after the school notified its accrediting body that it would close, the Middle States Commission on Higher Education said in a news release on May 31st. The Philadelphia City Council voted June 6th to hold hearings to examine the university's sudden closure and its impact on the city's higher education system and the school's current students and staff. Pennsylvania Attorney General Michelle Henry's office confirmed to NBC News that it is reviewing the circumstances of the closure and any transfer or loss of assets. DJ Jean, a rising sophomore who is studying vocal performance at the University of the Arts, said attending college has been a personal milestone. I'm a first-generation American, let alone I'm a first-generation student. My dad did not finish high school. My mom didn't go to college, Jean said. I grew up with just my father, and it wasn't a great upbringing. I eventually ended up in foster care at 16, John said. College never felt like an option to me financially. Jean was able to attend the university after receiving several scholarships, taking out loans, and working part-time jobs. But now, they are unsure of what's next, and said they feel trapped after signing an apartment lease in Philadelphia. I spent so much money to go to this school, and I put so much trust in the faculty and the board. It's an investment, Jean said. You would think that after putting so much more money into something when it's going away, the people responsible would want to inform you, and they'd want to let you know, here's what's going on. But they weren't interested in that, and it made me feel very disrespected and made me feel like I wasted my money, they added. The university is facing criticism from students and staff about what they say has been a lack of communication and transparency from the administration.
And we'll have to cut that article short for time. The next article comes from the Chronicle of Higher Education, and it's titled, Professors Ask, Are We Just Grading Robots? Some are riding the AI wave. Others feel like they're drowning. By Beth McMurtry, posted June 13, 2024.
Jeff Wilson is a professor of religious studies at the University of Waterloo. Since ChatGPT appeared on the scene, he has warned his students against using artificial intelligence to do their work. Even so, he says, he saw a massive uptick in its use over the past academic year, estimating that about 25% of his students at the Canadian institution used generative AI in their assignments. Some relied on AI to write responses to 150-word prompts. Others used it to complete an experiential learning assignment in which they were supposed to do mindfulness meditation, say, and then write about the experience. When he asked why, some students said they knew it was a mistake to do so, but they were pressed for time. A few didn't know they had used generative AI because it's embedded in so many other tools, like Grammarly. Others flat out denied using AI, knowing, Wilson surmises, that it was unlikely they'd be investigated further. The explosion in AI use, the endless hours spent figuring out whether, as he put it, there was a person on the other side of that paper, and the concern that students who cheat could end up getting the same grades as those who did the work, sent Wilson reeling. I've been teaching at this university for 17 years, and suddenly this comes along to devalue everything I've done to become a caring, competent instructor, and the students are creating make work for me, he says, describing the shift as devastating. I'm grading fake papers instead of playing with my own kids. The tension surrounding generative AI in education shows no signs of going away. If anything, faculty members are sorting themselves into two camps. Some, like Wilson, are despairing over its interference with authentic learning, and deeply worried they will have to scuttle the meaningful assignments and assessments they've developed over the years because they have become too easily cheatable. Others agree that AI abuse is a problem, but focus instead on how AI could enhance learning. Or they have found ways, in the short term, at least, to minimize its abuse while maintaining the integrity of their assignments. Some argue there's a third camp, the professors who so far are ignoring AI's existence. Members of both groups, however, agree that administrators need to provide more and better support for faculty members, who remain largely on their own as they try to adapt to this rapidly changing landscape. Professors complain of receiving generic AI guidance that encourages them to experiment with the tools in their teaching, but without providing tested examples of how to do so. Others say that unless students confess, it's often pointless to try to bring forward an academic integrity case, even with evidence, because of the difficulty in proving AI use. The lack of guidance and training is of particular concern, experts say, because AI will soon be everywhere. AI tools can now listen to and summarize a lecture, as well as read and summarize long academic articles. Now we have to start thinking about more than just assessments in AI. We have to think about learning itself, says Mark Watkins, a lecturer in the Department of Writing and Rhetoric at the University of Mississippi. Watkins and his colleagues were experimenting with ChatGPT in its earliest days, and he has become a savvy consumer not just of generative AI, but of how companies are marketing the various tools to students, often through influencers on TikTok. Most professors and administrators, Watkins believes, don't fully understand this marketplace, something he has been focusing on in a series of articles on Substack. The landscape will only get more complicated, he notes, with developments such as OpenAI's ChatGPT Edu, which aims to expand generative AI's use on college campuses. Watkins says he tries to neither despair about AI nor become a cheerleader, but instead adopt a stance of curious skepticism. He gives an example from his first year writing course, where he tested out a reading assistant in the spring of 2023. He liked the idea that the tool could help students with hidden disabilities or those who struggle with English as a second language. I thought at the time this would be great, he recalls. And it did, in fact, help some of those students, he says. But what scared me was that everyone else in the class said, "This is amazing. I no longer have to read ever again for anything I have to do, because it turns any sort of digital document into a Cliff's Notes on demand. I didn't even think about that before I deployed it."
He began the next class talking to students about why offloading their reading was a bad idea. He finally got through to them, he says, when he asked how they would feel if he used the AI reading assistant to grade their essays. They said, "You can't do that. You'll be fired," he recalls. My response is, "Fired for what? There's no ethical consideration yet for any of these tools. We have to create this in real time." Some instructors find they have to push back against their colleagues and peers when urging more caution around AI. Yolanda Gonzalez, an associate professor of English at McLennan Community College in Waco, Texas, has heard instructional designers on her campus argue that faculty members should worry less about cheating with AI because they can't yet prove when students use it. Her response, "It's her job to ensure students develop basic writing skills, and the noticeable uptick in AI use is impeding those efforts." For our developmental students, those we know lack the basic skills needed to get through college, we are doing them a disservice if we're not distinguishing between what is acceptable and what is not, Gonzalez says. And we'll have to cut that article short for time. The next article comes from Politico, and it's titled, "Federal Judge Delivers First Blow to Biden's Protections for Transgender Students." The case, quote, "demonstrates the abuse of power by executive federal agencies in the rulemaking process," the judge wrote. By Bianca Keelanton, posted June 13, 2024.
A federal judge has temporarily blocked the Education Department's final Title IX rule, which prohibits discrimination based on gender identity and sexual orientation. The ruling, Western District of Louisiana Chief Judge Terry Dowdy in an order Thursday declared that Title IX, a federal education law that bars sex-based discrimination, was written and intended to protect biological women from discrimination. Such purpose makes it difficult to sincerely argue that, at the time of enactment, discrimination on the basis of sex included gender identity, sex stereotypes, sexual orientation, or sex characteristics, Dowdy, a Trump appointee, wrote. Enacting the changes in the final rule would subvert the original purpose of Title IX. He also stated the case demonstrates the abuse of power by executive federal agencies in the rulemaking process. The Education Department said it is reviewing the ruling and that Title IX guarantees that no person experience sex discrimination in a federally funded educational environment. The department stands by the final Title IX regulations released in April 2024, and we will continue to fight for every student, a department spokesperson said. Key context: the preliminary injunction blocks the Education Department's rule from taking effect in August in Louisiana, Mississippi, Montana, and Idaho, a suite of states that filed one of at least seven lawsuits being pursued by Republican attorneys general. The ruling limits how the agency can enforce the rule's transgender protections at schools in these states. Several states, including Louisiana, Montana, Florida, South Carolina, and Oklahoma, had already said they will not comply with the new rule. And more than two dozen states are challenging the policy in federal court. Dowdy said he believed the states and more than a dozen Louisiana school boards challenging the rule proved their case could be likely to succeed because they demonstrated the final rule contradicts federal law and exceeds statutory authority, among other merits. The judge also ruled Bostock v. Clayton County, a landmark Supreme Court case that said it is unlawful to discriminate against people based on their gender identity or sexual orientation in the workplace, does not apply to Title IX. The Supreme Court ruling has been one of the Biden administration's core pieces of legal rationale to support its new interpretation of sex discrimination under Title IX. Reactions to the ruling. The Louisiana-based lawsuit, which was one of the first in the nation filed to challenge the rule, was backed by the Defense of Freedom Institute. The group was founded by former Trump administration officials who were key in crafting the DeVos-era Title IX rule on sexual misconduct, which was overhauled in the Biden administration's new regulation. When President Biden's Department of Education issued its Title IX regulations last April, we at DFI pledged that we would fight back, said Bob Adel, DFI co-founder and former senior counselor to former Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. The court has preliminarily enjoined the Education Department from enforcing these odious rules in the states of Louisiana, Mississippi, Montana, and Idaho. We are confident that other courts and states will soon follow. The Human Rights Campaign, an LGBTQ+ advocacy group that has lauded the department's rule, slammed the judge's orders as MAGA theatrics. Today's decision prioritizes anti-LGBTQ+ hate over the safety and well-being of students in the state, HRC President Kelly Robinson said. This is MAGA theatrics with a dangerous goal of weaving discrimination into law. HRC will continue to mobilize communities and work to make sure that all students are protected under law.
The final article comes from the Washington Post, and it's titled, Tennessee School District Where Students Held, quote, slave auction settles with DOJ. Hawkins County School District, where students allegedly called a black classmate slurs, agreed to implement reforms under a Justice Department settlement. By Daniel Wu, posted June 13, 2024.
A Tennessee school district where federal investigators said students subjected a black classmate to repeated harassment, including calling him racist slurs, hitting him, and holding a mock slave auction to sell him to white peers, will implement several changes under a settlement agreement announced Monday. A 2023 Justice Department investigation found that administrators at Hawkins County School District in Northeast Tennessee led a racially hostile climate, take root in two schools by being slow to investigate reports of harassment, and, in some instances, not disciplining perpetrators and discouraging students from reporting further abuse. Students passed around a drawing of a Ku Klux Klansman, made whipping noises at a black student, and added him to a group chat filled with racist slurs, the department alleges. Hawkins County School District, which denies the allegations, agreed to overhaul its anti-harassment procedures by hiring a compliance officer, creating an electronic portal to track complaints, and reviewing anti-harassment efforts. The district did not respond to a request for comment Wednesday afternoon. Our school system is, and always has been, dedicated to serving and protecting all students, regardless of race, Hawkins County Director of Schools Matt Hickson said, according to the Associated Press. Therefore, we entered into the agreement with DOJ to continue pursuing those same goals, and we look forward to working with the department regarding the same in the future.
And we'll have to cut that article short for time. We've run out of time for this episode of Education Today. Please be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Education Today is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.